Welcome to Bessemer, a podcast about healing, addiction, psychology, and spirituality. So, my name is Dr. Andres Gonzalez, and I'm a licensed acupuncturist here in California, and I'm a medical doctor in Mexico. I was trained in China, acupuncture, and Tuina massage. And I've been working with addiction for almost 8 years now. And we're going to be talking today about how this project, Bessemer, can help people with addiction.
Yes, yes. I'm Dr. Susan Swartz. I'm a licensed marriage family therapist in California and a licensed clinical psychologist in California. And I've been working in addiction for about the last 4 years, and I've been working with people dealing with all kinds of things, including addiction, almost 20 years. And Bessemer just came out of my work and our work. And it's where I think, at least from what I'm seeing, it's where I think I'd like to see treatment and rehabs go.
So why do you think you wanted to start Bessemer? Like what was the main idea behind it, and what inspired you to start this?
I love working with people with addictions. I've spent so much of my career learning how to work with trauma, and so often underneath the really stubborn kinds of substance use disorders, there's trauma. And I guess, you know, part of what makes me want to do this is how many really wonderful people we've lost. Yeah. It's been really hard. And those people, I just always wonder, you know, what could we have done differently? And I keep seeing people that we're not reaching. I keep seeing people walking away before they're ready to go. I you know, we just know they're going to relapse. They're not ready to go yet.
So why don't we talk a little bit about Bessemer?
Yeah, Bessemer. Bessemer is just, it came because how I think treatment ideally would be, it would start with the body. So that's where the B comes from. It starts with the body. And then soul spirit is, I think, next most important. And then mind, and then relationships.
It's beautiful. And I mean, body is probably the first thing, because we are living bodies, right? We live in a body. So would you like to expand more on why B first?
I just think that, you know, from our work, I mean, when I think about how, when you and I have worked with people combining acupuncture and psychology, I mean, the results have sometimes been really astounding. And, you know, I love EMDR because it really checks in with the body. And the body's so helpful. The body's so helpful. And I feel like so many people are just really cut off from their body. It's not their fault. They just are. We are, you know. There were times when I was. And the body has so much information for us, so much wisdom for us, and we can get a sense of peace and congruence and a deep kind of self-awareness that gets rid of a lot of the noise. And I think it's reassuring and it's powerful. And also, like we've talked about, you know, I don't think there's a distinction between the body and the mind. I think they're really one.
And that might be the core of everything, right? Because if we believe there's a distinction, how can we help one with the other, right? But if we believe that it's just one entity, right, we can help the body through the mind and the mind through the body. So it's a very, very interesting concept. And I mean, from the Eastern point of view, you know, you treat the mind, you treat the spirit, you treat the whole system through the body, right? I mean, the needles go in the body, and the massage, right, touches the body and all this stuff. So, yes, I agree the body is the part where we should start the work.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people with trauma, they accidentally sort of blame the body, you know, that the body was the culprit and the body, you know, drew in the perpetrator, the body drew in the abuse. And I think it's a child's way of seeing. So, you know, child's way of thinking is different than an adult's way of thinking. And so they are on some level unconsciously kind of at war with the body, and the body gets punished. The real problem is, though, you know, if the body and mind are one, then the person's punishing themselves at a deep level, and that really has to stop. And I think the best way to stop it is through yoga or tai chi or some kind of conscious kind of breath-based movement that gets them out of their mind and gets them seeing the body's role differently, I think.
It's beautiful. I mean, there's so many techniques, right? Like grounding, like people, you know, touching rocks or touching like rubber bands against their skin and things mm-hmm. like that to remind them, right, of the present moment and not to like follow the, I'm going to call it the trip of the mind.
Yeah, and it's funny, as we're talking, I'm like, why didn't I put spirit soul first, you know? But I think that through the body, we can start to sense soul and spirit, you know? What do you think about spirituality? Well, I mean, like, what do you, like, you know, what do you think about putting the body before spirituality or putting spirituality before the body?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, it's a very interesting concept. I think clearly spirit comes before the body, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, without the breath of life, without the animation of the soul, there's mm-hmm. no body and there's no point.
I mean, part of the reason I put body first is I just don't think people can attend to chanting or singing songs to God first thing. They just can't. I just don't think they can go from walking in off the street to doing that kind of stuff. But I think if they did some yoga first, I think that would kind of soften them up and kind of settle them down and kind of open their heart and mind. And I think that's the ideal preparation for some kind of a spirituality practice. But I think you're right. I mean, definitely, I think the spirit soul stuff definitely comes first. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you're right because it's the conceptualization, right? I mean, clearly it is more important the spirit and soul, but in order to get there, right, we have to start somewhere. And what better place to start with the body where is where we are living currently, mm-hmm. right? Of course, we can go to more metaphysical realities later on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the end of the day, yoga is a transformation. Right? Yoga is not to look hot or an exercise to make your glutes look better.
Yes.
Right?
Oh my God.
It is
yes.
a transformative exercise
yeah.
to get you into another state, right? Samadhi or one mm-hmm. of the other states that they say in Sanskrit, right? Mm-hmm. So, what better way to start like that, right? With a body.
Mm-hmm.
So, what is the next letter in the Bessemer?
Mind, M.
Mind.
Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, traditional psychotherapy methods would come in. But I think that if traditional psychotherapy comes in at that point, it'll be fundamentally different because the body, there'll already be a process of developing like a peaceful, loving relationship with the body. There'll be a dialogue with the body, and then there'll be a dialogue with what is, with whatever's out there, whatever gives us this breath. I mean, it's a mystery that we have breath. It's a mystery that we have another breath, you know, and the mind likes to say it's in control of that, but in fact, it's not. So once we put the mind in the right place, you know, then I think that the whole psychotherapy thing can really take root.
Well, it seems to me like what you're saying is that the client would be more in touch with themselves,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they're more in touch with themselves, with their body, and mm-hmm. they have a loving relationship with themselves,
mm-hmm.
then psychotherapy is almost, you know, have more probability to work.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just really starting to think that it's inside that context that these other things have to come first. You know, we have to kind of rein in the mind. We have to show the mind its place. And that's what I think it's about, you know, and I think like, you know, acceptance and commitment therapy goes about it a different way. This is how I think I would go about it, you know, a much more kind of concrete kind of, you know, I think simpler way to just say, hey, mind is not the ultimate authority, you know, and body, I think breath is what connects us to this mystery And so that's why it also needs to come before mind.
I like it a lot. It's, you know, when I think of the rehabs that I've been working on, they, like you say, the emphasis is first on the mind. And you have this depressed people, right, that they can have a better relationship in their mind with themselves and conceptualize and have a better idealization of the problem, but they're still not able to get up from their chairs, mm-hmm. right? And that's a problem, you know? So what better way to first get you out of the chair?
Yeah.
Right? And maybe even that will change something in your brain. Well, clearly will change something in your brain,
mm-hmm.
right? So I love it. I mean, I think starting from the body, it's a very, very important way to start to heal.
Yeah, I mean, for me, yoga changed my life, you know, and that's why I became a yoga teacher and why I opened a yoga studio and why I opened another yoga studio is because yoga saved me and yoga helped me in a way that, that therapy never did. And I just, I don't know, it's amazing, you know, and I think what you said earlier is so true. You know, yoga is not about having a hot body. And that's part of the reason why I didn't like being a yoga teacher and studio owner. I got so sick of that question. When is my butt going to get smaller? I don't know. And that's not what this is about. You know, I'm not about trying to make, you know, everybody look hotter in a bathing suit. You know, this is about this helped me, you know, this helped me to not have an eating disorder. You know, this helped me to not hate my body. This helped me to stop pulling out my eyebrows. This helped me to stop feeling sick every night about my life. I mean, yoga saved my life. And I just feel like then I got into therapy and I love therapy and I know therapy helps people, but there is this missing piece, you know, that people still, they worship their mind. And I don't know how to change that. I'm wondering if maybe putting yoga in there, putting chanting in there, maybe that will help people to recognize that they're making a choice to worship their mind and their mind is killing them. I don't know how else to teach it, but I think that's the important thing, you know, that I can't just fight the mind directly. I have to help people see that the way they're approaching the mind is completely wrong and ultimately self-destructive.
That's great. I mean, and your story reminded me of mine with Tai Chi, right? The movements helped me get out of depression, right? So I could read all the self books that you wanted. I could read the Tao Te Ching several hundred times. But the movement is what made my body change, you know? And I had this desire to stay in bed all day. I had this, you know, lethargy, not wanting to move, not having any drive at all of anything, sexual, environmental drive, to do nothing, you know, social drive, nothing. I just wanted to stay in bed all day. And the movement, going out to the park, it may be nature now that I mention it,
mm-hmm.
right? I could feel, you know, with each of the breathing and of the breaths and the movement to one side, to the other, after 5-10 minutes, you know, my mind started to, like it was like maybe pushing right the something down the road, like a car, right? And the beginning is super, super hard, and then like a snowball effect, maybe like the snow, right? It just creates an avalanche of energy, and then I was, you know, wanting to do it more and kick higher and jump higher. So movement with your body is super important. It's definitely one of the cornerstones of a healthy lifestyle and a cornerstone of addiction. You know, addiction is part of it. And we can talk in another episode about people that are also addicted to exercise, right? That's yeah. Another story.
Yeah, that's a tough one because that really does seem like a healthy addiction. But yeah, it can be excessive. It can be.
And maybe the mind plays a role there too, right? When you get this obsessed, and if I don't have this body, then I'm cursed, right? Mm-hmm. If I don't have this, then I'm nothing,
mm-hmm.
right? So it can mm-hmm. become also a mm-hmm. counterproductive thing.
Well, yeah, I think that sometimes people can accidentally sort of objectify themselves
mm.
and feel like I won't get the love unless I have this body, or I won't get the attention or the jobs or the, you know, approval or the respect unless I have this look, you know, and you know, and to me, that's just maybe another way in which people, you know, they could be in a different relationship with their body, but it's really about, you know, what's working for them. And for some people that's working, you know, and, you know, I certainly don't want to mess up what's working for people. You know, this is really for people who aren't happy. You know, this is for people where things aren't working. This is for people where it's just the stuff they used to do that used to help just isn't working anymore. People are looking for another answer, another way, you know, because I know, in my 20s, I had it all, but I was miserable. I was miserable. And, you know, and one day I just gave up. I just gave up and I just thought, I just got to try and be happy. I got to stop pushing myself, you know, and yoga really helped me to stop believing everything my mind said, because I believed everything my mind said. I believed the dreams. I believed the nightmares. I believed the commands. I believed the suggestions. I believed everything. And I was miserable, more and more miserable. And I don't know, yoga eventually gave me a little light at the end of the tunnel, a little break from the cloud cover, and a little bit of a sense of like, oh, it doesn't have to be like this. I don't have to be miserable. I don't have to feel sick at the end of every day, like I messed up again today, like I made it worse today, you know? And I don't know. I just, the only way I can help people is by showing them the path that helped me.
And now that you mention it, it seems like the mind could be a prison or a liberation, right? And when you're able to go to your body and show that liberation to your mind, feel that liberation, then you're putting the path straight for the mind.
Well, yeah, and let's just jump straight to the end, right? And we've talked about this, that like sometimes when I help people as a therapist to get happier, I feel like I'm not telling them the whole story, that there is another part to it, and I feel like I'm holding back on them, and I don't like it. And that's also part of, I think, Bessemer. That's why the spirituality, you know, because for me, what really helped me to be happy was the spirituality. It just put everything into the right environment. And if I don't tell them that, I'm not telling them the whole story. So that's part of why spirituality's in this treatment.
Spirituality is a way to liberate yourself, right? To bring liberation from your body and from your mind, right? So it transcends those two things. It goes beyond any physical, mental, emotional, energetic level, right? It is something that entangles the whole. And by the whole, we mean the whole cosmos, the whole universe, the whole consciousness, the whole that we know and we don't know of existence, right? And maybe non-existence.
Well, yeah, and I think that, you know, so much of what some people with addiction struggle with is just the human condition. But the human condition is placed in a whole other context when you think about spirituality. And, you know, it's funny, today I was thinking about the guy, all I know, his first name was Santosh. That's all I remember. His first name was Santosh, which means contentment in Sanskrit. And I remember I was teaching yoga out in El Cajon, and we were just talking after class about spirituality. And I said, you know, what's your deal? And he told me his deal. And I was like, that's so cool. And I said, you know, who do you read? And he said, I read this guy named Nisargadatta Maharaj. And I was like, what? And he spelled it out for me. And I had to write it down a couple times because I'd never seen a word like that. And I started reading the book, I Am That. And it helped me relax. It helped me sleep. It helped me in so many ways. And it wasn't any kind of spirituality I'd ever seen before, but it helped me so much to just put everything into perspective and to have deep peace in my heart. And then, you know, I've studied Kundalini and I've studied like chanting, and I don't know, that stuff really, really helps me. And I feel like if I don't give clients that, I'm robbing them of a really important piece.
Right. I mean, the way that it happened to me was more with Buddhism, right? I mean, I was born a Catholic, but I guess in Mexico, everybody's born a Catholic.
You're kind of born a Catholic, right? Yeah.
But I was raised a Catholic. And so to me, Jesus Christ was, you know, the biggest mentor. And, you know, he always goes back to love yourself, like love thyself, like you love your, or love your neighbor, like you love thyself, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was always thinking like, okay, but what does that mean? Like, how do I do that? Mm-hmm. Right. And then how do I do that when I have so many things inside of me that I don't like, right? That how do I love myself? And then when I read Buddha and he was saying, you know, your whole suffering comes from attachment, right? I said, oh, okay, but this is the second part that I was missing, right? Because I am suffering, so how can I love myself if I'm suffering? Because I'm suffering off my choices. And then it turns out that those choices were just attachments, right? And I'm attached to these things, and that's what's creating my suffering. So I said, oh, okay, this is the second part. I wish it was all in the same book.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, I grew up very Christian. I grew up watching evangelists on television. I mean, I love Jimmy Swaggart. I mean, forget about it. I watched them all. And I also loved Jesus, and I felt like I had a very close relationship with Jesus, and I felt loved and I felt connected, and it was very, very beautiful. And then I went to a Christian school and had chapel once a week and memorized Bible verses. And I loved all of that. I really did. I loved it. It's just something really bad happened. And that was called puberty and having sex and not having sex inside marriage. And then I felt like God hated me. And I mean, clearly there was some spiritual abuse for me back there, but, I just felt really cut off from God. I felt cut off from Christianity. It's just that I also needed something else. You know, for me, it was Vedanta. For me, it was these, you know, Indian saints, and they just put it all in perspective for me. But yeah. It's like sometimes organized religion feels like, and maybe Jesus did give all the answers. I just didn't get it from what I was reading.
Right. And I think another important thing is that when we talk about spirituality, at the very essence, you know that they're all talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. The problem is with man comes and makes his rules. Oh, you can only listen to mine. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you start creating division and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great.
Yeah. And I want to help people, you know, find their own way. I want to help people find their own path, you know, and I don't know what that is. And they may right. eventually choose to do nothing, or they may choose one particular mantra or I don't know.
Their own mantra, right?
Right. But I do feel like I at least need to talk with them about how important that is, you know, that was for me, and to introduce them to it, and then let them see if it has any change for them, you know, drop them into an hour long chant. And let them see if they have any results. You know, the proof's in the pudding. But if people don't try these things, they're never going to see anything new, you know?
R is the next word.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Our next letter.
So where I was working recently, they did a type of psychodrama, and I thought it was really, really powerful. And I felt like, wow, it's extremely healing. And it's a lot about relationships, because basically you take a moment that happened to you and you reenact it in three dimensions, almost like a theater piece with people, you know, almost strangers, maybe some people you know, but people in a group with you. And it's just so powerful. And, you know, then there are other people who say that we can get some of the things we didn't get as children. We can get that through, you know, forms of psychodrama. You know, if we didn't have a loving mother, we can actually, some people say, experience that in a psychodramatic form with strangers. And that's powerful, you know, that we might be able to heal our relationships and indirectly heal ourselves with psychodrama, with groups. So I think that's powerful. It's kind of, there's kind of some kind of recursive thing going on between, you know, the I and the you, between me and my relationships, right? Because I bring me into relationships, but relationships also let me know who I am. It goes back and forth. So I feel that by focusing on relationships, it helps the individual and it helps the relationships. And ultimately, I think we want love and we want healthy, happy relationships. And if we don't have them, it makes us very, very hopeless. And I think that so many people with addiction struggle with failed relationships and a kind of hopelessness or despair about them.
Yeah, I believe it's a cornerstone also, right? I mean, 99.9% of addicts have terrible relationships, right? With society, with their environment, with their family, with their loved ones, with everybody.
Well, I think that's a little extreme, but I think you love controversy.
Right, maybe 99.7.
Yes, yes, yes. And even though they might have some good relationships, they are certainly strained.
Right, because relationships, again, with your environment, with yourself, with your loved ones, right? If you don't have honesty, right, how can you have a relationship with your parents or with your son or your daughter or your loved one, right? It's all a lie. And at the end of the day, lies, you can see through them, right? Maybe not immediately, but with time you'll see, oh, yes, they were lies.
No, you're right. You're so right. That addiction just, it corrodes relationships and it drives people away. I mean, I just think, you know, how long can somebody watch someone they love kill themselves? How long can someone watch someone just destroy, methodically destroy their lives until nothing is left? You know, it's very, very hard to watch. And I think sometimes people have to leave the lives of someone with addiction just to kind of save themselves.
Right. Yes. I mean, I totally agree. I've seen it, right? That they create this healthy boundaries in a way and say, hey, I can't do it anymore. You know, it's not, you're not only killing yourself, but you're killing me because mm-hmm. I love you and mm-hmm. I see all the pain that you're creating. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I can't help you.
And the other sad thing is that sometimes even when people get sober and even when they maintain sobriety, sometimes those relationships don't get healed.
Right.
How do you tolerate that kind of suffering? You know, and that's again where I think you have to have some kind of spirituality that you can lean on.
The Bessemer Podcast is sponsored by Addiction Research and Healing Sanctuary, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to relieve the suffering of people living with addiction and to help them achieve their goal of long-term remission, regardless of their ability to pay. This endeavor is only possible through your contribution and donations. Please help us by visiting our website, addictionandhealing.com, and subscribing to our podcast.